Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and it's open forum for both hours today. Open forum meaning if you have a question having to do with the Catholic faith, with the Catholic Church, with Catholic teaching, sacraments, the Bible, all of those questions are welcome, and you don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. The number, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And I will let you know that on these open forum days, the lines start to fill up fast. So if you have some question that you have been itching to have answered about the Catholic faith, now is the time to dial. Get in that queue, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of the brand new book, Teaching with Authority, among many, many other things. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for being with us here this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Also, I say you're the author of many things, but you're also the caster of many things, among them Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yes, true.
That people can catch at
SQPN.com, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is the easy way to find it. This month, December, we're going to have episodes on Are We Living in a Computer Simulation and Would It Matter If We Did?
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going to have an episode on John F. Kennedy's mysterious Dr. Feelgood, who also treated loads of other celebrities.
I remember and, that. Yeah.
And find out some very interesting stuff you don't hear about too much. Then we're going to have, right before Christmas, an episode on when Jesus was born.
Oh, good.
And then we're going to have an episode on the hunt for the lost planet Vulcan in our solar system that astronomers 100 years ago said they found, but it ain't there now.
What happened to it?
Well, you have to listen to the episode.
Was Vulcan a Roman god?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Because isn't that's
the god of the forge.
Okay, so that's the names of the planets generally have Roman god names.
Right, and okay. Because Vulcan was sighted between Mercury and the sun, it would have been
really?
A very, very hot planet, and so they named it Vulcan after the god of the forge.
Ah, so it's not the same Vulcan that Spock hails from.
No.
All right, fair enough. I'll be interested to find out about that.
Yeah. But it may have been responsible for the name of Mr. Spock's Vulcan, because that name was floating around in, society.
Is any chance that it fell into the sun?
You'll have to listen to the episode to find out.
Oh, man.
There are chances of things falling into the sun. That's how the sun got there in the first place.
Stuff just kept falling in until it got dense and hot.
Yep.
888-318-7884, the number, 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer that version. And lots of calls, Jimmy.
Yeah, awesome.
Let's go to Tyler in Michigan, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Tyler, thanks for downloading our app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy, Cy, how you guys doing? I'm calling because I was talking to a Jehovah's Witness yesterday, and we started talking about the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned that there was a verse, and I'm not familiar with the verse, but that flesh or blood will not enter heaven. So how do I reconcile that Jesus ascended into heaven, Mother Mary, and as well as our bodies in the second coming?
So the statement that flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom of God is an indication that we in this mortal life will not experience and especially in the unglorified state that we exist in right now, that we're not going to inherit or enter the next life in that way. We will, however, after and by God's grace, after this life, we will enter it. And we will enter it both body and blood, and with our own souls. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses will acknowledge that, because they will acknowledge that people are going to be resurrected. They have some erroneous ideas about the resurrection, but they do believe that there will be a resurrection of the dead. And so, obviously, there will be people who will be in the next life. Jehovah's Witnesses even acknowledge that there will be people in heaven with God. And so I'm not entirely sure what the point of the argument they were making was.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not too sure either. I mean, it was just kind of quick, and I wasn't familiar with the verse, but I did want to kind of just get an idea of what you had to say. But so what he was saying that there was a difference between the spiritual body and the physical body. And I think what he was trying to get to was that the physical body will not make it into heaven, but the spiritual body will.
Yeah. So there, the passage that you want to look up for all this is 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul is discussing the resurrection of the dead. And Paul does draw a distinction between our earthly bodies and what he calls a spiritual body that we'll have then. If the Jehovah's Witnesses were interpreting that to mean that we have a non-physical spiritual body different than that we have some kind of non-physical body, then that's a problem. Really, what Paul means when he talks about the spiritual body is our resurrected body under the influence of the spiritual powers of the age to come, so that it's no longer a purely fleshly material body. It's been upgraded so that it's like Jesus's. Jesus obviously had a body that continued to be able to manifest physically. He ate fish, for example. He allowed the apostles to handle him, you know, to feel that he really did have a body. And obviously, Jesus's body inherited the kingdom of God and went to heaven because that's where he is right now. And so the same thing's going to be true of us in this upgraded form.
Tyler, thank you very, very much for getting our open forum started today. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, and I should be frank with you, whenever Jimmy's here, we also are more lenient to take questions of a more generally religious nature or philosophical or moral questions. 888-318-7884 is the number to call. We are moving right along. Let's go to Zelia in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Zelia, thank you so much for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Okay, one of my sixth grade students asked me when Jesus was born, and I told her that there was a lot of debate about it. Some people thought in the spring, and some people did think it was December 25th, but it didn't matter as much as that this was when the church decided to celebrate it. And I could tell she wasn't satisfied with the answer, so I'm hoping you can tell me something that will satisfy a sixth grader that's very inquisitive.
Well, I would say that the answer that you gave her is basically correct. There were people in the early church who argued, not just argued, but who just said that Jesus was born on December 25th. There were also people in the early church who said he was born on different dates. Some of them were in the spring. Some of them were at other times of year. The first person in the early church I'm aware of to address the specific day of Jesus's birth is Clement of Alexandria, who was writing just before the year 200, and he said it was November 18th. So you had a variety of different dates proposed. There's also an argument for September 11th that's quite interesting. But you were correct. We don't know for sure, and it ultimately doesn't matter for purposes of faith what specific day Jesus was born to redeem the world. The fact that he was born and did redeem the world is what's important. And to give us a way of celebrating that, we use December 25th, but it's not a teaching of the faith that he had to be born then. There's been a lot of discussion of this. If you go to in scholarly circles for a long time, if you want an article that goes into a little bit more detail on it, I would suggest going to jimmyakin.com, where just this Sunday, so just yesterday, I published an article on this subject. And also, I've got an episode coming up in a few weeks on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where I talk about it in more depth as well.
Zelia, thank you very, very much for that. Have you ever heard these things? I mean, I'm sure you've heard them, but I just kind of tune them out, but I want to check with you. Sometimes people try to gauge the date of Jesus' birth according to the star, like it was some kind of astronomical phenomenon that you can look back to. But that doesn't strike me.
You mean the Star of Bethlehem?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The problem is there are multiple candidates for what the Star of Bethlehem could have been.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to know Jesus' birthday first in order to, or at least the year in which he was born, in order to figure out when, which candidate for the star works. You can't start with the star and infer the birthday. You have to reason the other way around.
Well, again, Zelia, thank you so much for that call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. If you have a question about Catholic people, Catholic faith, Catholic beliefs, you are welcome to call 888 888- 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Through midnight tonight, this is another one of these kind of flash sales we've been having. We're offering free shipping on the biggest bestsellers, Made This Way and Why We're Catholic. And you can save money on hundreds of other items in our online store. Just enter CALIVE18 at checkout when you visit shop.catholic.com to save 20% off hundreds of items in our online store, including books, DVDs, CDs, MP3s, and ebooks. Be sure to catch Trent Horn and Layla Miller also. Those are the authors of Made This Way. On At Home with Jim and Joy on EWTN this Wednesday and Thursday. Check your local listings for times or the EWTN app, which you should have. It would be delightful if you did have it. You'd be happy you did. Go to shop.catholic.com for savings. Put in promo code CALIVE18.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The Church has 2,000 years of wisdom to share on what it takes to live life gracefully.
We're so overwhelmed by how much our faith has transformed our marriage and family especially. We want everyone to experience the incredible gift that the Catholic vision of life and love really is.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. Tomorrow morning, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
I understand the concept of...
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Next hour, Father John Trigilio will be here. Both hours are open for him. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call with any question you have about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. We go now to Austin in New Orleans, listening on WQNO. Austin, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, gentlemen. My question is, from my understanding of man, is composed of body and soul, but at times in the Bible there's mention of spirit, and it's not very clear to me, you know, is spirit part of the soul, or so I just needed some clarification on that, Jimmy.
The terms are used in different ways in different passages, and so fundamentally, this is something the Catechism talks about if you want to look it up in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but fundamentally, there are two components in a human being. There's the physical component, and then there's the spiritual component. Sometimes the spiritual component is referred to using the word soul. Sometimes it's referred to using the word spirit. Sometimes the two terms are distinguished from each other and may represent various things. For example, sometimes the word soul is used to refer to the entire person. We see that, for example, when in English, when we say the ship sank and 20 souls were lost or something.
Right.
We see that same kind of usage in Genesis, where it says that God took the dust from the ground to make the body of the first man, and then he breathed the spirit of life into its nostrils, and thus man became a living soul. So that would be an example of that. Also, though, it's possible these terms had different nuances, different connotations, but they didn't refer to something fundamentally separate. There are not fundamentally three parts in man in terms of what he's made out of. But sometimes soul and spirit are distinguished, but they still primarily overlap. And ultimately, there are only two fundamental components of a human being.
Okay. All right. Thanks for clarifying that, Jimmy.
No problem.
They have a lot of – oh, thank you, Austin. They have a lot of soul in New Orleans, though, right? But that's a totally different meaning.
Totally different meaning.
Soul.
I have a lot of that everywhere. I think of Detroit more with soul.
And yeah, that's right.
Zydeco more with New Orleans.
That's a good point. Yep. Queen of Soul. Do you know who that was?
Aretha Franklin.
Oh, man. I thought maybe I'll get one by. All right, Connor. Let's see if Connor can get one by you. Connor in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Yeah, so my question is, I'm wondering about the biology of Jesus. So he received, like, he was conceived by Mary, and so you would think that he'd receive all of his, like, biological aspects from her. So you'd think that she'd be kind of like the spitting image, or Jesus would be like the spitting image of Mary. But my question is, where would he get his Y chromosome from?
Okay. So the answer is we don't know for sure, but there are several things we can say here to shed light on the question. The first thing, it's true that you can, in some circumstances, and some species actually do this. They have a natural process of parthenogenesis where even though there's no father, a female is capable of reproducing. But when that happens, the in species that have gender that works like ours or similar to ours, the result is always female because you don't have an introduction of male DNA that could result in a male offspring. But what you don't always find is that the offspring is a clone. A clone is a genetically identical being, so has exactly the same DNA as another being. And something we've mentioned here on the program fairly recently is the fact that identical twins are clones. They have exactly the same DNA. And the way they get that DNA is originally when a pregnancy occurs that ends up resulting in identical twins, there's one original embryo that then splits early on into two embryos, and each one of them has identical DNA. So if on chromosome one of the twins has, let's say, an A variation, they're called alleles in genetics, but one of them has an A variation and an A variation because each gene has – or each chromosome comes in pairs, then the other twin will have an AA variation. If the twin has an AB variation in the two chromosome ones, then the other twin will have an AB variation. And so they're going to be identical. Whatever one has, the other one's going to have. But in the case of God taking – if God took all of Jesus's genetic matter from Mary except the Y chromosome, then Jesus wouldn't be just a clone of Mary with a Y chromosome. The reason is because God, let's say, might have taken two ova and supplied a Y chromosome and used the genetic matter from two ova to produce Jesus. Well, in that case, let's suppose Mary on chromosome one had an A variant and a B variant. So because Mary had two copies of chromosome 1, let's suppose she's got – one of them has an A variant, one of them has a B variant. Well, Jesus, depending on the ova that were selected, might have an A variant and a B variant with chromosome 1, or he might have two A's, or he might have two B's. And so he wouldn't necessarily be genetically identical to Mary. He would – his DNA would all be a subset of Mary's, but it wouldn't all be the same combination. And so he would have certainly, in any event, he would have borne a resemblance to Mary because he's her son, but it may not have been, you know, identical except for a Y chromosome. So that brings us to the Y chromosome. Where did that come from? Well, it so happens that Y chromosomes are smaller than X chromosomes, and so it's possible that God could have taken an X chromosome and then edited it down to be a Y chromosome. I mean, he's the God of the universe. He has the power to do that, so he could have done it that way. He also could have created it out of nothing because he created the whole universe out of nothing. Or he could have modified other matter he got from somewhere else into a Y chromosome. And so we don't really know where Jesus got the Y chromosome. We can presume that he had one because that's how sex works in our species, and he was a human. But if God can come up with a Y chromosome, then he could come up with a whole slate of 23 chromosomes. I mean, it from other than you coming from Mary, he could have come up with a whole slate of 23 other chromosomes, either out of nothing or by modifying other matter, and combined that with an ovum from Mary in the in a miraculous but otherwise normal way, and so only half of Jesus's DNA may have come from his mother. The other half could have been created out of nothing or been modified from another source, and so in that case, Jesus would have would be normal in that half of his DNA came from his mom, just the same way with all of us. Half of our DNA comes from our mom. We don't really know the answers in this area, but those are kind of some of the parameters.
Okay, Connor?
That was fascinating.
All right. Well, happy, it was, wasn't it? Well, we're very happy to take your call. Call anytime, Connor. We appreciate it. 888-318-7884 is the number. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Patrick on Facebook says his pre-ordered copy of Teaching with Authority has been shipped and is on its way. He's anticipating getting his book pretty soon. So that's Jimmy's new book, Teaching with Authority.
Yeah.
It's getting out there, Jimmy.
Awesome.
It's getting out. So you could probably order it and it'd still be there for Christmas.
I would hope right so. Now. Depends on the shipping speed you pick, but sure.
Oh, yeah. Right. If you pick delivered by snail,
yeah,
then probably not. I don't know if we offer that as an option anymore, though.
I don't think there's a lot of demand for it.
No. It was FedExing kangaroos is a bit.
That's different.
That's a whole different thing. Jordan in Detroit, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Now that is where soul comes from. Jordan, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good evening, guys. Thank you for taking my call. Sorry, I'm going to switch up actually what I told the prompter. I've decided that this other question takes priority. How were the first popes in the early church elected, so such as like Linus, Cletus, and Clement?
Mm-hmm. The answer is that we don't have records of exactly what the selection method was at the time. There are some indications that they may have been appointed by their predecessors. There are some indications that they would have been elected by the clergy and even the people having a voice in it. That was a common method when a bishop had died in the early church to have the local clergy and people take a vote on the subject or at least hold a meeting on the subject and arrive at a consensus. But we don't have the record of the specific election methods that were used in the case of the early popes. What we have is a record of who they were because the churches were concerned to preserve succession lists that listed who came after who, but they weren't as concerned about documenting the specific procedures that were used in an election.
Greg, can you recommend, like, is there any documents that you can see, like, that succession happening? Like, what if there's letters out there that show that succession?
Well, one of the most accessible works that's most easily accessible on this subject is a book that was written around the year 320 by a man named Eusebius of Caesarea. It's called Church History. You'll also see the title translated as Ecclesiastical History. And he was an early historian in the early 300s who chronicled the first 300 years of church history. And he documents from different sources the successions of several different major sees, including Rome, Jerusalem, Alexandria and Antioch. And so as you go through church history, he'll talk about then this guy became the Bishop of Rome and then this guy became the Bishop of Rome and so forth.
Okay, Jordan, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very, very much for that call. Our number, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You mentioned all those early sees of the church. Is Damascus one of them, or is that a later city?
Damascus is a city that is in Syria, and it's to Damascus that St. Paul was going when he had his conversion. So we know that it was an early site of Christianity. There were Christians there, including Ananias of Damascus, who played a role in Paul's conversion.
Right.
But it wasn't one of the major sees like Antioch itself was or Jerusalem was.
Okay, I gotcha. I just thought of it because it's I think today's the Feast of St. John
of Damascus.
Yeah.
He's the last of the church fathers in the East.
Oh, that's what we say. We call and around when then?
Would he have been? 749.
Oh, yeah. It would have to be pretty late because he was It was
so already into the Middle Ages.
Yeah, Islam had come into Damascus by John's time. Okay, 888-318-7884. The number, James in New Iberia, Louisiana. You are up next, James. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Mr. Jimmy Akin. I'm in this conversation with this radio talk show host. He's very anti-Catholic, and he said that Jesus, with regards to the Last Supper, could not have commanded his apostles to drink his blood because it goes against the Old Covenant command in Leviticus 17.
All right, James,
not to drink.
Okay, we got the at least the start of the question, but we're going to have to hold the rest till for just a couple minutes. Can you hang on, James?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, James. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Author Mark McNeil spent years in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, praying in its lively services, zealously spreading its unconventional teachings, and rejecting mainstream Christianity as misguided. Then he left it all behind. All in the Name is the story of a man who believed he was among an elite group of believers who followed the true faith when so many others had strayed. But an inquisitive mind, careful study, and the action of the Holy Spirit finally led Mark out of Oneness Pentecostalism and into the Catholic Church. This is an inspiring conversion story you won't want to miss. It's a faith strengthener for Catholics and an intriguing challenge to those who deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Order your copy of All in the Name today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent already upon us, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new resources by Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Christopher Check, and other great Catholic teachers, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Your Best Self.
We'll help you remove the roadblocks to being your best.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, Father John Trigilio next hour, and both hours are open forum. Anybody can call with any question at all. Oh, I made a little rhyme there. Didn't mean to. That was, wow. All right. Put that one in the books for me, will you? Thank you. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. James in New Iberia, Louisiana is on the line. And James, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you. So you were asking about Jesus commanding his apostles to drink his blood in the context of the covenant?
Yeah, exactly. So he's saying, this Protestant is saying that, well, he couldn't have done that because he would have been breaking Leviticus 17. Mm-hmm. He and his apostles would have been breaking that law. Mm. And, you know, it seems to me, well, I went ahead and said, well, no, because I read Leviticus 17 and it says that the life of those creatures that you're not supposed to drink the blood from, it says the life is from their blood. And I said, well, Jesus's life is not in his blood because he's God, which is why all creatures die and they all come back to life. Jesus came back to life. So I use that route, and I think that's a pretty good explanation, but against, you know, what he was saying. But also he was saying that Jesus was under the old covenant Mosaic laws, and I don't see how that's possible. Him being God, he's not you know, like a descendant under Abraham, whereby he is under sin of any kind. And I, from my understanding, the law unto the descendants of Abraham was because they were sinners.
Okay.
No, the law was given to everybody, whether they were a sinner or not. If you were a descendant of Abraham and if you were going to participate in the blessings of the covenant, then you needed to keep the law. And I would not challenge the Protestant radio host on the idea that Jesus was under the law. He was. We're told he was by St. Paul. We're told that, for example, in Galatians 4, that Jesus was born under the law. And we also see from the very beginning, if you look at Luke chapter 2, Jesus's parents are doing for him at the temple when he's an infant, according to the custom of the law. Jesus also doesn't have a problem submitting, even though he himself is not a sinner, as the book of Hebrews makes clear, he doesn't have a problem submitting to rituals that were instituted for sinners. Thus, he doesn't have a problem being baptized. When John the Baptist starts to balk, Jesus says, no, let it be so now that we may fulfill all righteousness. So he sees a purpose in him going through this ritual, even though he's not a sinner and he doesn't need it himself. So Jesus was someone who kept the covenant. As God, he became incarnate and voluntarily assumed the obligations of the covenant as a Jew. And so that was his choice to do that. He didn't have to do that, but he did. Now, in terms of what does that mean in terms of ability to tell people to drink his blood? Well, obviously he did that. I mean, he told them to drink his blood. He said it, and the Gospels record him saying it. So unless your Protestant radio host friend is saying the Gospels are wrong in attributing that statement to Jesus, then he needs to acknowledge Jesus said it. The question is, did Jesus mean it? And the fact that Jesus was a Jew and thus was under the law in some sense does not mean that he didn't modify the law. He did, in fact, modify the law. He challenged certain principles that had been part of the observance of the law all the way along. And most notably, he challenged the food laws. If you look in Mark chapter 7, you'll see that in the context of the debate about hand washing, where Jesus's opponents have observed that the disciples don't wash their hands before they eat, Jesus makes the point that nothing that enters the body from the outside makes a man unclean. And so nothing means nothing. And Mark, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, draws the inference from that therefore Jesus declared all foods clean. Well, that's going to include blood, because blood is a food. It's not one that we eat a lot in an American diet, but it is used as a regular ingredient in cooking in other parts of the world. And if nothing that enters you from outside is going to make you unclean, then blood entering you from outside is not going to make you unclean. And so at that point, we would have to say, okay, so given that Jesus reconfigured the way the dietary laws of the Old Testament worked, that's going to apply to blood just as much as it did to other things. So I don't think that your friend's argument from Jesus being under the law is ultimately successful. There are other reasons as well. Now, obviously, we have the explanation for why you don't get to under the old covenant, why you don't get to eat blood was because the blood is the life, and so it belongs to the Lord. And saying the blood is the life, that's a metaphor. Really, blood and life are not the same thing. If I have, you know, a pint of blood in a plastic bag, I don't have a pint of life in a plastic bag. I have a pint of something that can sustain life.
That's going to be very disappointing to vampires. All the vampires are going to be.
Well, it might even sustain unlife in their case.
Oh, okay.
But it's not literally life, so that's a metaphor. But operating on the metaphorical level, okay, so there's one person whose life it's okay to have in us. the spiritual life that comes from Jesus and his work on the cross. And so that being the case, there would be at least one person whose blood it would be okay to drink. Also, we're not drinking Jesus' blood in the sense of metabolizing it, which is really what the book of Leviticus is after. It's talking about drinking blood in the normal sense and then metabolizing it so your body uses it as fuel. And that's not what's happening when we drink the precious blood. Our bodies may dissolve the accidents or appearances of wine, but Jesus' blood literally is up in heaven in his body and ceases to be present in our stomachs as the accidents dissolve, so that we're not metabolizing his blood the way we would if we just drank ordinary blood. So there's another difference there. And there's also something else to think about. If it were fundamentally wrong to ever drink someone's blood, then Jesus wouldn't have been able to, or it seemed to me, Jesus wouldn't have commanded his disciples to do it as part of a sacrament. Because even if it was just meant symbolically, that's like taking a sin and telling someone to symbolically commit a sin as part of a sacrament. And so that seems quite counterintuitive. I can't imagine Jesus saying, oh, here is a sacrament. I want you to commit sexual immorality symbolically. I want you to murder someone symbolically, and that's going to be your sacrament. That doesn't make sense to me.
James, we will leave it there. Thank you very, very much for that question. 888-318-7884, the number. Open forum today. Craig in Findlay, Ohio is up next. Craig, your question for Jimmy Akin. Hi, Craig. Are you there? Nope. No, Craig.
It's unfortunate.
Maybe he'll go. We'll come back to him. We'll see if he's around. Kathy in Beaver Creek, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. You are up next, Kathy. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Thank you. I wondered what foods Jesus would have eaten besides fish, lamb maybe, and drank wine and water. And I had a second question, if you can take it whenever.
Okay, well, so Jesus would have eaten a normal diet for a first century Palestinian Jew. That would have included grains like wheat and barley. It also, which were raised in Israel at the time, would have included dates. They had date palms that they would use. It would not have included things like corn or tomatoes, which were native to the New World and thus were not discovered for another 1,400 years. But he would have had olive oil, would be another principal component of the diet, would not have included rice. They didn't raise rice there. But those are some of the additional foods. It's also possible that occasionally he may have had wild game. In addition to on occasion, because sometimes people hunted and would, you know, kill a deer or something like that. Another common food besides lamb and beef would have been goat. That would have been something that would have been available as well. And, of course, cheeses made from and other dairy products, whether made from sheep, goat, or cow's milk, would have also been available.
Okay. Also on baptism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're made a child of God through baptism. Is that right?
That's correct.
So what is a child if they're not baptized? Then they're not a child of God.
So there are different senses in which a person can be a child of God. And that's illustrated by the fact that Jesus himself is a child of God in a very special sense. He's the Son of God in a way nobody else is. We may become adopted sons and daughters of God, but he's the Son of God in an intrinsic way. He's always been that and could not fail to be that. So that shows us that the term child of God can be used in more than one way, and it can be applied even to non-baptized people. There's a sense in which every human being, as someone who bears the image of God, can be referred to as a child of God, but that doesn't mean they have the special kind of relationship with God that people who are baptized Christians do. An example of of a passage that talks about how even unbaptized people are able to be children of God is found, if memory serves, in fact it is, it's in Acts 17, it's Acts 17, 28, where Paul is talking to the Areopagus, which was a kind of discussion club among pagans at Athens, and he's talking to the Areopagus, and he points out to them that even though they come from a pagan background, they have some awareness of God, and he points out that even some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. So some of the Greek poets have recognized that there is a divinity and that in some sense mankind constitute his offspring. But Paul is talking to people who are not yet baptized. So even unbaptized people are also children of God in one sense, but that is brought to a new level when we become conscious believers in God and are baptized into his family in a new way.
Kathy, thank you so much. We have to take a quick break, so we will leave it there. But if you have a question for Jimmy Akin, give us a call, 888-318-7884. I want to continue to keep reminding you that we have these sales that are going on. Sometimes they last a day or two or three as we approach Christmas. And through midnight tonight only, we're offering free shipping on our biggest sellers made this way and why we are Catholic. Just go to shop.catholic.com and order those books, and you'll get the free shipping. And a whole bunch of things are 20% off if you just put in the promo code CALIVE18. CALIVE18, and you will get those savings.
This is Bishop Robert Barron, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
She was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin here with us this hour, and we go now to, Craig is here in Findlay, Ohio. Let's go back to Craig. Craig, we missed you before, sorry. Your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, Jimmy, so I was raised in the Catholic Church, and then later on in life I went to the Protestant faith, and just listening to you guys and really just encouraged by what you guys are saying, and just makes me kind of spark some questions as a Protestant now. You know, since I'm not officially in the Catholic Church anymore, I'm kind of wondering, are there any practices or any doctrines that would essentially condemn me because I'm not in the Catholic Church anymore?
Well, so there are a couple things to say here. The first one is we can't pass judgment on another person's soul. You are in a better position than I am to know the state of your conscience before God. So I couldn't presume to judge whether you're I couldn't judge you one way or another in your case or in anybody's case. What I can say is that Jesus establishes a principle in the Gospels that that we'll be held accountable for the amount of knowledge we have and what we do with it. So he uses a kind of earthly example of if you have a servant who's disobeyed his master, he's going to get punished. But if the servant knew what he was doing and disobeyed deliberately, he's going to get a worse punishment. Well, God's not going to punish people who didn't know sincerely through no fault of their own, who didn't know that they were doing something wrong. God is more fair than a human master, and he treats his children better than a human master treats his slaves. But the principle remains true that to the extent, and this is why Jesus told this parable, to the extent that we knew what we were doing was wrong, or that we should have known that what we were doing is wrong, but we ignored evidence or covered it up or let ourselves get tempted by something else, to the extent we should have known it was wrong and disobeyed, to that extent, we will be held accountable. So, Craig, I would say that, your situation is going to be affected by factors like how much did you really understand the Catholic faith? How good of an education as a Catholic were you given in terms of this is why you need to be one when you left? What were the reasons you left? And then, as with all of us, as we learn more, as we grow in life and continue to learn new things, we're then held accountable for how we use that new blessing of knowledge that we have. So I can't say, and the Catholic Church would not say, that you're automatically condemned, but the fact that you're away from the church right now is not a good thing. It's not what God wants for you. And to have evidence that the Catholic faith is true and just say, I don't care, I'm going to do my own thing, well, that could lead to condemnation. But it's a sign of hope and grace that God is working in your life, that you're listening to the show and that you're being intrigued and you're finding what we're saying informative and helpful. And so I would just be very encouraging and say, keep listening. If there are particular questions we can help you with, by all means, call in here on the air or call the apologist line off the air where they can spend even more time with you and keep pursuing your path with God and be open-minded and prayerful and see where he leads you. And we will be more than happy to do our part in providing you with evidence and answers.
Okay, Craig.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Once again, I love listening to you guys. I got a hold of you about a month or two ago and haven't stopped listening to you. So really appreciate all that you do and as well. So
awesome. And when you're ready to come back, all you need to do is go to confession. Or that's the fundamental thing you need to do.
All right.
Yeah.
And thanks for the encouragement, Craig. That means a lot to us. We appreciate it. It is open forum. I'm going to keep moving. I want to get everybody in that I can. By the way, second hour is open forum as well. So if we don't get to you by the top of this hour, then just hang on. Father John Trigilio will be here with you the second hour. Paul in New York, you are up next. Paul, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
Good question. First of all, let's talk about the dormition of Mary. Where do we get that knowledge that Mary was assumed into heaven? Dormition, I guess, is not part of our Bible.
So let me give you an answer to that, because we're coming down to the end of the hour and we want to get to another call if we can. The word dormition means falling asleep. And so that's actually a reference to the death of Mary, which is something that can be inferred from the fact that Mary was an ordinary human who was not naturally immortal, was not living in a glorified state. We can infer that she died. The question is, what happened then? Unless God intervened to prevent her from dying, like assuming her before death. But the common opinion among theologians is that she did die. In terms of where we get evidence for the assumption of Mary, that's something that primarily comes from tradition. It has been proposed that there are some passages of Scripture that may reflect it in one way or another, such as John seeing the woman who gives birth to the Christ child in Revelation 12, and he sees her in heaven. Some have said that may reflect the assumption. It doesn't prove it, but it may reflect it. And there are, but it's primarily from tradition that we know that. What's your other question?
The other question has to do with, you had talked about the earliest writings of our church, which kind of put the Eucharist aside as something special and holy, different than communion. Was there some kind of writing around 100, 110, or 108 that was the earliest writing that talked about the Eucharist and how it was shared and why it was different I'm trying to understand, you know, when I explain our faith to our brothers in Christianity, they don't understand that Eucharist thing. And where is the evidence of that?
So you mean the real presence?
The real presence, correct.
Okay. So I'm not entirely sure what you may have heard, but there are documents that talk about the real presence that are quite early. An example of that is found in the letters of Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius was the bishop of the city of Antioch around the year 108. He was being taken to Rome to be martyred, and on the way, he wrote a series of letters to the churches he was passing and also to an individual named Polycarp. And in these letters, he talks about how various heretics that he was aware of refrained from eating the Eucharist because they did not confess it to be the body of Christ. So he has a realist understanding of the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. That's something we have a lot of material about online at Catholic.com for you. If you go there and look up our Church Fathers tracks, we have one on the real presence that will quote Ignatius for you. It's also in my book, The Fathers Know Best.
And Paul, as Jimmy said, we want to try to get as many calls as we can. You're always welcome to call back here anytime you got a question. Let us go real quick now to Stephanie in Dallas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Stephanie, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, just a quick question. So in the Canticle of Mary, it says, "All generations shall call me blessed." Mm-hmm. There's a dispute going on between me and some friends whether it should be said blessed or blessed.
Okay.
And what the difference is between the pronunciations, and does it matter?
There's no difference in meaning. Blessed and blessed both mean exactly the same thing. Originally, this is from a word that meant happy, but it's taken on different connotations over the course of time to mean in English, like someone that God has favored or shown his favor to, thus giving them reason to be happy. He's given them his grace. And the reason for the difference in pronunciation is that all of those ED suffixes that we have used to be pronounced as a separate syllable in English. So instead of saying stopped, at one point we would have said stopped. And instead of saying
stoop,
it would have been stupid. Yeah, there you go. So all of those ED suffixes originally were pronounced as a separate syllable. But over the course of centuries, as the language has evolved, we've started to soften that distinction and blur the final syllable into the syllable preceding it so that, which is natural because English tends to accent the syllable before the last one, called the penult. And so that d is the only little bit of the sound that remains from that second syllable when you slur them together. And so blessed is simply a more recent pronunciation of blessed. But because because religious practice tends to be conservative and preserve older usages, that's why you tend to run across blessed in prayers when you don't run across it in ordinary speech. It's because and similarly, like in the Beatitudes, blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor.
Right.
It's because religion tends to conserve older usages in language. That's the same reason why we have the Our Father as Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. You know, if we were going to say that in modern English, it would be Our Father which is in heaven, or Our Father who is in heaven, let your name be sanctified.
Yeah.
But because English is, and not just English, but religion is conservative in the way it uses languages, you get blessed instead of blessed. Ultimately, it's not going to matter which one you pick. I would just say pick whatever most of the people in your group feel like going along with and go with that. But it's not going to matter beyond that. And if there's someone who really feels strongly and the others don't care so much one way or another, go with the people that feel strongly, because you don't, you want to get together, and if some people don't care so much, then go with the people who do care.
Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks very much. We continue with our open forum next hour. Father John Trigilio will be here, so if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy Akin, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And people can find you at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or just search under Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you got that brand new book, Teaching with Authority, and JimmyAkin.com. And
JimmyAkin.com is the hub for everything.
That's the hub where you can get all the Jimmy Akin you want. All right, be right back with more Catholic Answers.